My father, who died, and he had all these polyester shirts, but he had one real nice shirt, and it was a Levi blue corduroy shirt. And about, '84 or something like that, I was up here being the village philosopher, and I took off my shirt and laid it down. It was that shirt. And then I proceeded to forget it. Went to Lost and Found 3-4 days, wasn't able to find it. Went to, wrote a letter so they could post it to see if it ever be found. He said, it's sentimental reason. I mean, it had holes in it and everything else, but it was my dad's shirt. And then we went back to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I was the campus pastor there at the University of New Mexico, and eventually moved to St. Cloud, Minnesota. And at midweek worship service, sitting around, a new person came in, and I kept, while we were going through the liturgy and I was preaching, I kept looking at this shirt. And lo and behold, I asked this guy if he'd ever been to Holden Village. And he says, oh yeah, I lived there. His name's Don Shuba, if any of you know. No, Don Shuba. And I says, by chance, did you get that shirt at Holden? And he said, oh, I get all my clothes from the Lost and Found. So we ended up playing a game of ping pong, and he came up, and he says, hey, that pastor beats the shirt off you. He gave me my shirt back. But, just a bizarre story to think. From Holden to Albuquerque to St. Cloud, Minnesota, I got my dad's shirt back. So I still had, I was going to bring it up and wear it up here, but I chose not to chance that. Providence or luck probably only works on occasions, and I didn't want to risk it. The topic I'm presenting this week is on the spirituality of civility. And tonight we'll be looking, after I spend some time dealing with what that title means, taking a look at the fact-value split for this session. Tomorrow, I will be also dealing with another foundational aspect of this spirituality, which is the acknowledgement that we must need enemies and know who those enemies are in order to do this spirituality effectively. And then we skip, by the way, the structure is great. I'm now in the evening in this room. Tomorrow I'm in the morning in that room. Then I skip a day. And then I think I'm over there in the morning, then over here in the afternoon on Friday and Saturday. So please bear with it. But the third day, which is Thursday, which I think is the most important day, is when I will lay out a model that was developed by Pat Ellison for her dissertation thesis. And from the University of Minnesota, on how do we talk in a way about things that really deeply matter? How do we have moral conversations without, I would like to say, killing the other people or wanting to get so angry that you don't know what else you want to do but destroy the other person? And what I need to do in order to do that, what I want us to figure out in the next few days, is a topic that we who are gathered here might have radical disagreements on, so that we might be able to model and practice that method of moral deliberation, of moral conversation on Saturday. And so if any of you have some topics, or you've been hearing in the village some conversations about something that you think there might be some disagreement about, please bring them up to me and I'll be listening for them as well. Spirituality, as many of you know, is a very vague term. So vague that when Walt Bowman called me and invited me to come here under the slot of spirituality, he said, Darius, that's a topic that you can do anything you want and it will fit. And I almost took offense at that, but then I thought, well, it does give me a certain sense of freedom to do whatever I want and call it spirituality. And so I decided to title this, these times together, The Spirituality of Civility. But it had to be kind of like Alice in Wonderland, when I forgot who it was, mentions the name Jabberwock. And Alice says, "What does that mean?" And the person who she asked that to says, "Well, it means whatever you want it to mean. Do you rule the word, or does the word rule you?" And sometimes I think spirituality fits in that kind of, you know, you can name it, you can call it whatever you want, and it's okay. But what I want to name it, what I want to call spirituality, and in this case, Christian spirituality, is it's not a personal search for psychological health, as a lot of people think of it as, where you kind of follow your own bliss. Nor is it, on the other extreme, a personal search for some sort of other world. You know, a spiritual person is this person who is so totally otherworldly. But rather, spirituality is trying to view and see this world rather differently. It's really an incarnational way of looking at the world and seeing how and in what way God is involved in this world. And of course, you all know what the root of the word spirituality is, do you not? Spirit. Spirit, when you think about it, is that thing which makes you animated. It's that which brings you to your feet cheering when the Twins, coming from Minnesota, won the World Series. You know, the whole state was alive with spirit. And as Frederick Buechner says, it's what you don't have when you're dead. When you don't have breath, when you don't have animation, when you don't have life, you don't have spirit. So spirituality, I would like to think of as something that makes one full of life, makes one animated, makes one excited about where God is present in this world. And a long time ago, I don't know where I picked this up, was a view of history. That history was like a river, and the task of those of us who are Christian is to watch that river of time. And when you see God in history, our task is to jump into that river and embrace God there. Now, footnote on Bonhoeffer. When you jump in, sometimes you think it's God and you find out it's not God. But grace is sufficient to get you back up on the riverbank to look to see where you think God is at another time. Cheap grace is when you sit on the riverbank and point and say, "There goes God. There goes God." What a spirituality is all about is trying to perceive how God is active in this world and jump in, and God is active, you can say, everywhere, but how can we be attentive to where we think God is active and jump in and be present? The part of the river that I'm jumping into at this moment for these talks is where I believe God is present in having people of the church converse with each other about moral issues of the day without coming to blows. And this brings me to civility. I hate the definition of civility in almost any dictionary I look up. It's a big, big word nowadays too, you know. But it almost implies that you're supposed to be nice. It implies that you're supposed to be polite. But it's really much more intentionally about coming to terms with whatever topic it is you're dealing with, as I said, without coming to blows. Or as Walter Ong has said regarding the original meaning of the word campus, if you've never heard this, it's what I kind of paraphrased up here for this time. Campus is a place where people deal with important issues without the need to bear arms. That was the original meaning of the word campus, according to Walter Ong. Therefore, a civil place, a place of civility. And my question is, can parishes be such a place? Can parishes be such a place that people will actually want to come to this place, this parish, University Lutheran in my case, to discuss important matters without feeling the need to destroy, attack, belittle, put down the other person? And with the help of a Lilly grant that our synod, Southwestern Minnesota Synod, received, and Pat Ellison, who has just finished her dissertation on this topic and developing this model, we were one of five congregations in the synod who were field testing and trying to see if there's some sort of base point to see that it's even possible for congregations to discuss matters that are deeply felt and that deeply matter to people without trying to destroy each other or losing members over it, which is sometimes the fear. We, as a new congregation, when we started this project, we were a church in organization. We were developing our mission statement. We were trying to figure out what direction we wanted to go as a church. And it was very interesting to use this process just to try to figure out what it is we are all about. Other churches had deep-rooted traditions on what is the proper things to talk about, what is the proper things to do, and what you should do and shouldn't do. We only had those images based on previous experiences from other churches. So you could say we had it easier than some of the other churches. I'm not sure about that, but so be it. We are a liberal church. We in our constitution have claimed that we are a reconciled in Christ congregation, open and accepting to gay and lesbian people. We are a church also that does not use Robert's Rules of Order, but in our constitution we use a consensusful way of making decisions. And all of this is tailored, I think, to this topic. But it doesn't say that it can't work in the small, rural, farm country which this model is also being looked at and working. But having said all that, I want to also say that we were also very much aware of the divisiveness of any moral issue, and almost in this culture, the disdain and the distrust and suspicion and hate that is so alive and well whenever you start dealing with any issues that have values, deeply felt values, as a part of who you are. There's just those looks that people give you. There's that sitting up and leaning back. There's that profound there's that profound silence, that stillness that comes over a conversation when you hit that brick wall and you don't know where you're going to go with it. And how do you open ourselves up so that we can really discuss about some of these different things? And one of the things that I think is alive and well in our culture is that many people do not want to get along with each other as much as they want to be right. I mean, don't you realize that sometimes when you're talking with people? They could care less about how this is making you feel or if somehow this is going to move us, whoever us is, in some sort of direction. You're wrong and I'm right, and that's enough. And it's very hard to deal with that. Some people, all I can say is, well, it sounds like you think I need a lot of prayer. Can you pray for me? I'll pray for you. And who knows what might happen. The result is that we converse with one another and with our neighbors about matters that really matter less and less. We have moved from a front porch sort of mentality where people wander by and you talk to them, you invite them up on your steps and you get to know them, kind of what like the Holden, what Holden is all about, to a backyard patio in which nobody knows what you're doing. You only invite the select few back there to your inner sanctum to discuss things that really matter. You wake up in the morning with your radio on. You go to your car in your attached garage. By the way, we do this too. And you turn on your car and the radio is on. You push your garage door opener, the garage comes up, you back out your garage, you go down your street into, this is where the analogy stops for me, into your own garage at work, up an elevator with Muzak probably, and into your little cubicle. You don't have to talk to anybody unless you choose to talk to them. And especially about things that might be controversial. And I'm afraid that this brings up, when conflicts do come about, church people just don't know what to do. I mean, can't you think of good annual meetings in which something comes up and all of a sudden everybody just you're looking at the pastor or the chair of the council and you're just petrified, or you just say, oh, let's wrap this up, let's go home. When conflicts come, I have four different things that usually happens. We look for an easy answer, right? I mean, let's just get it over with and get it done with, because after all, I mean, coffee and rolls are being served in about a half an hour and we got to get on with it. So, you know, let's just find a simple answer to the solution and move on. Or we like to play ostrich, you know, put our head in the sand. Oh, we're not really here. You know, this isn't really happening here. What problem? We don't have a problem. Or we get, as so many people are doing nowadays, angry and cynical, and we murmur. I mean, I'm sure the village this summer has had some issue that there's been murmuring going on all over the place. And there's been little pocket cultures of people getting together and saying, I know what's right. I know what's right. And you just feed on each other because, of course, I'm only talking to you who agree with me and not this person over here who disagrees with me. And so we start accusing and we start finger pointing and we start blaming. And that's so easy to do when we're spectators. You know, oh, I can tell you everything that's wrong with the Minnesota Twins this year. You know? I'm a spectator. You know, it's a lot different when you're standing up there and seeing that ball coming to you and you're supposed to hit the thing. Or the fourth one is we stop going. What we end up doing is actually saying, this conflict is too much for me. Or you live in a state of denial and you seek out a different church where less controversy is happening. And we're wondering why. Why we seem so dead in the spirit, because there's nothing going on in churches that keep people alive. And I think what keeps people alive is good controversy, which I'm for one am scared stiff about. As issues become more complex, and now we've been hearing a lot about global issues in different other sessions, but I want to deal with local issues and let other people deal with the global issues, but they're interconnected. You can have an issue of, you have $30,000 given to you. Should you apply it to an organ fund or helping build a home for the homeless in your community. You know, I want both. They're both wonderful ideas. What do you do? Or the issue of God language in your parish. Who do you call God? What can you call God? How can you call God anything? Can you call God God? Holden's trying to deal with that with talking about expansive language. And the gay and lesbian issue is one that always gets some excitement fireworks going. But as issues become more and more complex, conflict becomes increasingly more acute. Whether it's out in the open or whether it festers underneath the surface like a sore that just doesn't want to go away. What we don't want to get along, I don't think, as much as we want to be right. Now, how many of you are members of a church? I was hoping most of you are. Just checking. I want to have a little bit of a discussion with you now on the question, what type of moral conversations would you like to see happen in your churches? I mean, if you can dream a little bit, what sort of things would you like to talk about, and how would you like to see them go? As you think about your church, wherever that is, your locality, if you can just share a few of those.
Well, I'll say something about ours in Agora. And I don't know if it's a business or you can say conflict or what it is, but and I think we have a healthy congregation, and I know there's a difference in ideological perspectives within the congregation, but when it came time to reflect on the first draft of the ELCA sexuality document and then the second draft, first there was no attempt to discuss the first draft because apparently some folks in the leadership of the congregation had just decided this thing's dead in the water, it's not going anywhere, no point talking about it. But then when the second draft came out, we did talk about it, but what I was one of the people who was asked to do something, and I was asked to compare these two statements. And then two other faculty from Luther were invited to come and share their reflections on the statement. And those three things constituted our study. It was all input. The congregation didn't talk about it. They heard what others thought about it. So I wish as a congregation we had been able to say, here's the thing, read it. Let's come and talk about it 3 or 4 weeks in a row. Break it down by section and have some kind of a method to discuss it. But we didn't, mm-hmm. And yet we could say that we had studied it, but we didn't really study it. We simply listened to others who had some opinions about it. So it's a frustration with ways in which controversial subjects are handled and not handled inadequately.
Or like a local pastor of one of our churches in St. Cloud, who was having an adult forum on it, having somebody else lead it, came in and sat down and wore a button to the first draft, just say no to the whole thing. Sure allows you to open up discussion, kind of a conversation stopper. Yes?
On the same issue, one of the things that bothered us at home was the polarization of that issue. There were no people in the middle, well, people in the middle just didn't have any opinions. They didn't discuss it, they didn't care about it. And
did they show up?
No, I was just gonna say, when we had there were two sessions to discuss it that were scheduled, and when my wife and I walked into the room where the meeting was, we thought we were virtually alone. There were 40 or 50 people sitting there, every single conservative and fundamentalist in the church was there. No middle of the road people, no left wingers like we were, and we were all alone. And all it was just venom that just kept spewing out about how terrible this thing was. And the misstatements, we began to wonder, did they read the same sexuality report? And there was no discussion. Mm-hmm. But we prayed from what we learned here at Holden and the discussions we have had here, that we had the strength to say something. We did. And there were a couple people who came up afterwards and said, you know, what you said made sense. We are going to study this a little bit more. But it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But the polarization was there, and nobody knew that.
Yeah. Couple more? You think of your congregation? Now remember, my second question, which I haven't given you, is what type of moral conversations do you usually see? My first question was, what kind of conversations would you like to see? But how quick we point to our experiences of what is wrong. Just, yeah, five times. That's okay. I can go with the flow.
Well, when you asked the first question, I thought, oh, I can't really answer that because we do a pretty good job, I think, of discussing the first draft. We had maybe at least five study sessions that we took by paragraph, and the way we did it, we used it as a study document, not as the last word, not as something we had to accept or not accept, but we just simply used it as, you know, let's see what we see here, what we agree with, what we'd like to change, what we'd like them to change, and then send them suggestions. And then it handled that way, the group didn't get so terribly upset. So when the second one came out, we got all through all that one, the first one, we're not going to do it again.
How many of your congregations actually have some sort of sessions on the human, if you're Lutheran, on human sexuality? How many of you did not?
It's hard to answer that because there's only 8 people there. You
know, yeah.
Each congregation, I think that job is typical.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to see is everybody put on the mind of Christ, be open, no taboo subjects, be sensitive to everybody else, you know, merciful, forgiving, wanting to be honest, you know, and nonviolent responses, nonviolent reactions, that sort of thing, and be open-minded enough to get the facts before making some premature decision. That's what I would like to see.
You know how I get that? By having a diverse congregation to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I think we're able to do what we do, because we are an educated congregation. We are reconciled in Christ congregation. We are a lot of staunch old conservative members. I mean, we're just a very big mix, and it's been hell, and it works if you. Work under the gospel with love. It works.
Yeah.
Amazing that it does, because it's very, very, could be very, very dangerous, I suppose.
I agree.
My contention is that as the complexity of an issue increases, moving this way, that the amount of conversation one has on it publicly decreases. And I've seen this over and over, but the amount of private conversations on it increases. And you run into all sorts of, I don't know if you call it schizophrenia or not, but mismessages all the time. And it becomes very, very dangerous, I think. And I think that this is because of the fact that we as Americans tend to keep public discussion focused on facts. And we move private discussions dealing with values and beliefs. And we only talk about those things in what I would want to call a navel-gazing sort of way, people who are like-minded people all too often. And we do this because we like to define, now I don't want to define it this way, but we all too often define facts as those pieces of information which cannot be disputed and which can be proven scientifically. And we define values as opinions or beliefs based merely on tradition, culture, or personal experiences. And as a result, we usually deal only with factual information in our public conversation. And when we deal with nitty-gritty basic information and issues, there are values being played out all over the place. And it permeates all the tough social issues. And basically, what we have here is a split that culture, whatever else you want to call it, a dividing wall that keeps our Monday to Friday world apart from our Sunday world. We go from the objective to the relative, the reasonable to the irrational, the science and the faith, knowledge and opinion. And we separate all these things. And what needs to be done in our culture is to somehow sabotage this wall. This wall is made by, which I've been hearing this week already, countless different times. Oh, by the way, I should give credit to our wonderful Bible study this morning, and I want to use Ephesians 2 as part of this talk because it just came alive. Correct me if I'm wrong here. How does this sit? In Christ Jesus, you are once far off and have been brought near by the blood of Christ. We were once, the Gentiles were a no people, and now we're part of the people. For he is our peace. He has made both groups into one, and he has broken down the dividing wall. Now, the dividing wall can be this dividing wall, the dividing wall between different types of people. It's also dividing wall, I would think, between my conscious self and my unconscious self. All this stuff is being played out in each of us as individuals, and also as us as a community, and also as us as who's in and who's out. Broken down the dividing wall that is the hostility that is between us, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death that hostility through it. Or as another translation says, killing the hostility through it. So he came and proclaimed peace to you who were far off and peace to those who were near. Both now have access to the truth. And so you are no longer strangers and aliens. That's the exclusivity side of all of this. You are no longer not a part of something, but you are now citizens with the saints. You are now connected, in whom you also are built together spiritually into a dwelling place for God. You're right. I mean, you don't need to add a lot of commentary to some of this. You just have to feel it. To be a dwelling place for God, in which people of all types of diversity can come together, where the dividing wall, and there's all sorts of dividing walls, can be broken down, or as I would like to call it, sabotaged. And this dividing wall, I think, can be sabotaged by whenever we see dualistic thinking, either or kind of thinking, right wrong type of thinking, simple and easy answer type of thinking. We can sabotage that by asking the question, is there a third way? I mean, Walter Wink, in his little book on Bible study, deals with that. That all too often, we constantly have to think about not the two groups at the church who has this way, and even though you're probably totally outnumbered in this way, but can we even come to the conversation thinking that both ways may not be the best way? That there may actually be a better way that nobody has thought about. See, we keep, we're in this mindset of individualism in this culture that we even think that I think and you think, and somehow that is separate. And there's not this synergenic kind of process that as we talk about issues, that there might actually be a different approach to it. And so we go into an issue saying, I'm going to convince you that I'm right. And you go into it, you're going to convince me that I'm wrong and you're right. And we've lost the fight, whatever the fight is, before we even begun. We can also sabotage it. My colleague, not on this topic, but on other topics, I have a higher tolerance for chaos. Cindy would know this too, my wife. I'm a slob. I have a higher tolerance of chaos, and I like to play with a lot of things at once. And my colleague just goes nuts at that, because here I'm juggling these things. And she just says, give me one of them, you know, and now another one. I wish I could juggle to demonstrate that. And how life is so much like that now, I think. And all too often, I get juggling too much that I can't keep them going. And they all just fall. And then, you know, how do you pick them up? I mean, ambiguity, isn't ambiguity running kind of rampant in today's world? And the more it runs rampant, don't we long for some sort of division and some sort of easy answers and some sort of right and wrong sort of thinking in order to stop the carousel I want to get off, sort of, you know, stop the world? Was that the play? Stop the world, I want to get off? I mean, things are just spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. And we start to believe that the unknown is something that can't be trusted and that has to be controlled. And the unknown is something that is suspicious. And you've all seen the movie E.T., haven't you? Don't you remember that unknown creature? Now you gotta really think way back when the first time you saw it, before all these dolls came out and all this other sort of stuff. Especially for kids, E.T. was a scary thing. I mean, you first saw that monster. They set that up in the opening scenes. It was very scary. But soon E.T. became this wonderful friend, this unknown entity, this thing that adults were always suspicious of, were always out to control, were always out to dissect and to sort through. And it was the kids who were able to learn to play with and fall in love with this unknown thing. Walter Capps once said that we have done a very good job of teaching people how to be critical. What if we would have spent the same amount of time teaching people how to be compassionate? How much different would our culture look? There's nothing wrong with being critical. There's a lot of good reasons for it. But are we critical to the extent of forgetting to be compassionate? And is the unknown really more gracious than suspicious? And if we can go into a conversation with an attitude of thinking that this unknown, which I'm scared stiff about because it might cost me my job or my friendships or whatever else it might be, that it could also bring a new sense of koinonia to the community, and to be open to that and to celebrate that, how much different just that kind of attitude would bring to the discussion. Yeah. Go for it.
I'd like to break in here.
Sure, go.
I'm not ELCA. We had
our Missouri wars back in the 70s, and you all remember those. And we tried, many of us at that time, to use the model that you're suggesting here. Mm-hmm. Let's keep it open. Let's get all parties represented. Let's have honest, in-depth kinds of conversations. And it misfired. It didn't go anywhere. I would hope that with this second human sexuality document, you have better success. You may well do so. That apart, I would like to just raise a question with the model that you're presenting before us here. And I would like to believe what you're saying, because I used to believe it myself, but I change it a little bit. When you plead, for instance, to go into the unknown, would it not be more gracious than suspicious? I think that's precisely part of the unknown. Part of the difficulty I have with this model, and this may only be a personal problem that I have, is that you ask us to sense, you know, the Spirit of God out there. But if you use the New Testament as a guide, a spirit doesn't just simply mean animation. Or let's put it this way, there are different kinds of spirits. Mm-hmm. And if one could be confident that in the unknown there is the Holy Spirit, then of course we could go forward cheerfully, not knowing where we go, but only that you are leading us. But it is you who are leading us. Jesus also went into the unknown, and he had a conflict with the unholy spirit. And during his lifetime, it was often in his ministry a conflict between the Holy Spirit and the unholy spirit. So that I want to search for the Spirit, but I cannot surrender my critical reason here, or my critical faith, because it is not simply, you must test every spirit, because, you know, many false spirits have gone into the world. And it seems to me that part of the problem that we have in conflict in the church is, maybe you're right, I gotta be right, and if I gotta be right, you're gonna be wrong. Can't we get beyond the right and the wrongness of it? Maybe we can, maybe we cannot, but if indeed what we're doing is testing spirits, because the Holy Spirit will only make himself known with unholy spirits, then one cannot go, as it were, so naively, and one may have to reckon with the fact that at Marburg, Luther and Zwingli got through 14 theses, and, you know, for 14/15 of that particular conference, they were on the same wavelength, or they tried to be, until around the 15th, finally, you got a different spirit. And it seems to me that that's one of the facts of human history, church history, and that's why I'm not quite so willing to say that you got to rule out right wrongs in discussions. I don't want to invoke it immediately, but I also don't want to leave it outside the room when we sit down.
And I hate when people do this, but, in fact, you did it, so I can do it. Tomorrow, we do have enemies. You know, we do have enemies. But we got to be very clear about that. I do, you know, there are some things I feel very strongly about. But at the same time, when we're dealing with principalities and powers, those testings of the spirit, I have to admit that I am only a person. And what this process is about is opening up a discernment of a larger community to test my provisional hunches that reform and inform what I think, God forbid, is right. And how do we do that in a way that is civil? I mean, like I said about that river, I may think God is there or on my side or whatever else I might be thinking about, and I may be discovering that God wasn't there at all. Can I actually keep open to the fact, or the opinion that God could be more in what you're saying than in what I'm saying? And can I be attentive to what you're saying? So much so that I may be converted to what you are saying. And that's the model that I think. I'm not saying that you should do away with this and jump over here. There are too many weird groups that do that. I'm just saying let's get rid of the dualistic mindset and let's bring values. Let's bring those. I mean, I shouldn't say. I don't want to say values and visceral in the same breath. But it made me think of. The one of the big key issues, I think, about homosexuality that causes all sorts of problems is that most people, it's just something visceral. They don't know why they got into feeling the way they're feeling about it. They just feel about it in some sort of way. And how do you use reason to get out of something that you didn't use reason to get into in the first place? It doesn't work, I don't think.
Is there something holy about that visceral response? Or does that necessarily, because it is merely visceral, have to be consigned to the unholy part of the equation? So that's the way I'd like to frame the question.
Yeah. Maybe the unutterable groanings.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this, yeah. Okay.
In other words, I see you're struggling to put reason over viscera, huh? You want to be more Apollinarian than Dionysian, and I don't know whether that's the necessary polarity that we have to use here, because it seems to me that Holy Spirit and unholy spirit can infect and affect both.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm not putting one above the other. I want to plead for kind of a both and. I want to juggle them both. Mm-hmm. Other people on this? Any other? Yeah.
I work as a therapist, and what we are learning now and working when there's marital discord seems to me a good model for what we're talking about here. We're not so much interested in that the couple have the same values or agree or even like what the other person believes in. What we're finding helpful and useful to that couple is that they understand, first of all, what the other really believes and thinks. And then secondly, respects it and respects that person's right to have that belief. And once that is accomplished, and once you learn how to do that, then you can be in relationship with someone that you may totally disagree with on many different things and still love them. Mm-hmm. And you can have a good relationship. And that seems to me, that's one of the crucial things that has to happen when you're dealing in a marital relationship where there's differences of values and differences of ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. Not to get them where they agree. And neither one is right. We don't worry about that. It's a matter of understanding and respecting the other person's right to have their own values and their own ideas and their own thoughts and their own feelings. And
I'm with you to a certain point, and now I'm jumping more on what I'm hearing you're saying. What I want to come back on is, what if my value, Cindy and I have been married now 24.9 years or something like that. My value is that I want to love other people. I want to love another woman, another man. That's my value.
Yeah.
And you should respect that.
Yeah.
I mean, there comes a point where something's gone haywire at that point.
She probably would choose not to live with you if that was your value, and she would go maybe and find someplace else to live.
Uh-huh.
But why continue the relationship if that were occurring, you know? But she could still respect you and still say you have the right to have your own way of living, although I really like you not to do that. I much prefer you have a way of living that I value, and I'd be willing to continue my relationship with you if you do. But if you don't, so be it. Which yeah, all need to
I don't think she'd be that gentle on me.
What tries to prevent is the condemnation of the other person, because once the condemnation occurs, there's no ability to reconcile, because you've evilized the other person.
Right. And that's a good point. You can have enemies, but let's not evilize that enemy in that sense. That's what we were talking about in an earlier session. Another way of saying that, I think, would be similar to what I've used different times as an example of Cindy's in my relationship early on. I would come home and be the first one home and would walk in, sit down, pick up a book or something and start reading. And Cindy would come home and say, "What? You came home before me and you didn't pick up this stuff?" And I would say, "What stuff? I literally did not see it. I had to train myself out of respect." Now, if I was Cindy, what would I see? Boy, did I see lots of stuff. You know? I mean, that's that part of that giving and taking. If we could walk in the shoes of another, those fundamentalists at that church that is out to just destroy you, you think, or something, you know, if you can start understanding how they're that way, I think would help us in our discussion. Any other thoughts? A story about what I'm trying to say here, that's a true story about myself, my daughter Sarah, and her great-grandmother, my grandmother Agnes. This is probably about 6 years ago, wasn't it, when she was probably about 5 years old. My grandmother was in a coma, and she was had an aneurysm, and she was just all black and blue, her left side of her face. And I was going up to see her at the hospital in Alexandria, most likely for the last time. She was in her 90s, to say goodbye. And I brought Sarah with me. And when we got there, I was fearful of the unknown. I was fearful of my daughter seeing great-grandma and going, "Yuck," or something of that nature. And so I held Sarah very close to me with her face this direction as I would look at great-grandma and start talking to her. And as we walked in, she pushed back and said, "I want to see great grandma." And so I turned her around to have her see great grandma. And then thinking she would yell, "Yuck." And she said, "I want to touch great grandma." And so I moved her closer to my grandmother, and I thought she would probably touch the nice side of her face. And she touched the black and blue side of the face. And then she said, "I want to hug great-grandma." And so I laid Sarah down in the bed with my grandmother, and Sarah hugged as only Sarah could hug. And my grandmother's eyes actually opened. She actually spoke. She said, "Wonderful, wonderful. I've been so blessed." And my daughter sat at the end of the bed for about 15 minutes, waving at great-grandma. And great-grandma waved with her little finger at Sarah. Metaphorically speaking, can we dare see, touch, and embrace whatever that conflict is out there in hopes that maybe somebody might say, wonderful, wonderful? I think we can. I think that all too often we fear, as I feared, that Sarah would blow it. But she didn't. Or another story that I think Dan Erlander has probably told up here, maybe some of you have heard it. Dan is was a pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church, where we were members as well in Albuquerque. And there was this little girl or boy who heard a siren and dashed out between two cars to see what it was, only to have the police officer kill the child. Single parent, the funeral was at St. Paul Lutheran Church. And this woman was a feisty woman. I mean, she just would like to stand up at annual meetings and speak her piece, and everybody would shudder. And as the casket was being rolled out and she was following the casket, she looked and she noticed the police officer way in the corner of the church. And she started to walk over to him. Now, once again, suspicious as we tend to be, we thought, oh no, what's going to happen here? And she walked up to this police officer and said, you must hurt a lot. Why don't you come and have lunch with us? I can't think of a better Eucharistic symbol, take, eat. I mean, what forgiveness is all about. Wonderful, wonderful, I've been so blessed.